All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the NASPA Small College and Universities Division podcast. My name is Jake McLean. I serve as the Assistant Director of Leadership Development and Service for Monmouth College in Monmouth, Illinois. Today on the podcast, we're going to talk with Dr. Heather French, who's the Vice President of Student Affairs from St. Louis College of Pharmacy, Dr. Daryl Holloman, who's the Vice President of Student Affairs at Spelman College, and Dr. Laura Linden, the Vice President of Student Affairs at Holy Names University. We're talking about keeping all the balls in the air, the constantly shifting gears and carrying the weight of it all. Some everyday cliches that ring true about the first year of a vice presidency. So Heather, Daryl, Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So talk to us a little bit about some of the things, how did we get here to have this conversation today?
Quite literally, we got here through the NASPA Small College and University Division, who are looking for interesting and innovative ways to bring topics to the SCU division, and really thinking about the journey of, you know, in this case, three small college SSAOs or VPSAs, and sort of some of those key lessons that we've learned during the time that we think might be of interest, potentially helpful, certainly things that we've learned and grown from.
Yeah, I would add that one of the things for me that led to this is that because Heather and I used to be colleagues, we have a monthly check-in where we just kind of were going through being a first year vice president together and talking about things, and we started to notice some common themes. And talk about some common themes. And so I think we also thought it might be there are plenty of other people out there either thinking about the job or in the job who might share those experiences. And so it would be good to talk about them.
Yeah, and I just think it's just the sheer stress and isolation of your first year. And then I found two wonderful anchors in Laura and Heather. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm not in this alone. And so we just want to share some of that anchor with the rest of our colleagues.
Yeah, well, like I said, before we hit the record button, I'm excited to be part of the conversation and help facilitate this. I think it's a great, I think this is gonna be the first episode of 2020. So all of the crazy things going on in the world, I think this will be a fun conversation. So. You know, on a cognitive level, many student affairs professionals might agree that the vice president or senior student affairs role is a lot of work. And on a practical level, it is, it's not really until you're in the role that folks really understand the mental and emotional fortitude that's required to be successful. So I'm excited, like I said, to kind of pull back the curtain and learn some of the lessons learned from you all in in the first year as vice presidents. And so playing a little bit more get to know you games before, because, you know, student affairs, we love our get to know yous. So talk to us a little bit about how long you've been at your institution, anything kind of, what should the listeners know about yourselves?
I've been at Spelman for 2 years. I just celebrated my anniversary. I came right at the time of the school's founding. And so I always can remember the date. And so I came the first week of April, which was a wonderful time to come. It's just so many traditions and such history at Spelman. So it was really amazing. I think the thing about me is I'm probably the most humorous vice president that you'll ever meet. I always am full of the jokes. But I am actually the first man to serve in this role as the vice president of student affairs.
So I have been at Holy Names for almost 16 years now. So I think I'm the one in the group who became the VPSA at an institution where I had already been working for quite some time. So I worked in both student affairs and academic affairs, had probably about six different jobs at Holy Names, and then became the interim VP for a month, and then became the permanent VP about a year and a half ago. And I would say just one other thing to add about me is that it was nice of you to introduce me as doctor. I'm not yet a doctor. I am in a doctoral program, so that's a whole other element of my experience, is getting on that path to that.
And I'm Heather French, the Vice President for Student Affairs at the St. Louis College of Pharmacy. Laura mentioned that we worked together previously at Holy Names, where I served as the Dean for Student Development and Engagement for 7 years before coming to SILCOP, which has been almost 2 years now that I've been here. I would say a few interesting things about my journey to this position. Geographically speaking, before coming to SILCOP, I really had never even considered living in the Midwest. And it wasn't an opportunity that I was necessarily seeking. But as it sort of came before me and really started thinking more about it and talking with folks, it did seem like a really neat experience, and just happened to be personally coming into my life at a time when my partner and I were ready for a new adventure. So we made that decision to move together to St. Louis, and I started here in July of 2018. The other thing, just kind of a funny coincidence, but a point of connection for my students and I, never before has this ever been relevant in my job search, but my very first job out of college, out of undergrad, I was a pharmacy technician. So that is, again, point of coincidence, but also something kind of special to be able to connect with my students about, many of whom are pharmacy technicians. Many of our students become licensed as undergrads so that they can practice under pharmacists while they're in school.
Thank you all for sharing the more, playing along with my more notes of introduction. As I told you earlier, I'm an ENFP, and so I'll jump around and kind of get all sorts of crazy and wild on you. luckily, we have a script and an outline to go by, and so I won't go off of that too much. You know, talking about the kind of first year serving in this role, Dr. French, maybe we can start with you. Talk to us a little bit about the things that you were maybe really excited about upon entering the role, and then some things that maybe you were fearful, or you know, the things that keep you up at night, sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Things that I was excited about, certainly just over the course of my career, having really felt a lot of excitement and passion around the breadth of the role, moving into a dean position where you're, you know, overseeing many different areas within student affairs and continuing to expand that, and seeing the ways that you can impact students through an administrative lens. I was really excited about that, and I think that aspect of it has continued to be really meaningful. I love working with staff and developing staff, and this has been a great opportunity for that. Of course, being able to impact the lives of our students, which is why I hope many of us have gotten into this field. So those are all the things that I was really excited about and continue to keep me really motivated in my role. Things that maybe I felt concerned or worried or kept me up at night. Large-scale student emergencies, you know, things that would involve potentially, you know, students being hospitalized, passing away, campus-wide emergencies, just really not only the fear of facing those sort of challenges, but just sort of the heartfelt pain that would be associated with working through those sort of issues on a small campus, where oftentimes I think folks would describe that relationship as more of like a family environment, where you really build these deep relationships, and that sense of loss is really scary. And I mentioned the large scale emergencies or crises. So I think probably all of my colleagues can relate to that, especially given the current times we're in.
I would certainly echo a lot of Heather's, you know, the emergencies and the crisis management and the students in real distress is definitely the thing I think that keeps all of us up at night. For me, it was an interesting transition because I wasn't, unlike some folks, I wasn't necessarily on a clear path that I was going to end up as a VPSA. And so it happened to be that it was the right time at the right institution for me to step into that role, and that my breadth of experience from both the academic side and the student affairs side was really what was needed at that time at the institution. So I felt really positive about stepping into the role, but also a little bit like this was not what I thought I was going to be doing. So so that's been a bonus and sometimes challenging, but it's also the part that I love about the job is that I'm able to use all of my experience and all of my skills in ways that I didn't know I was going to be able to do. I think of a sort of traditional student affairs background, you know, student activities or residence life. Those were all areas that I had supervised a little bit, but were not really, really strong in my wheelhouse. So just kind of figuring out how to bring, take advantage of colleagues and expertise of the people on my campus to kind of flesh out my experience in those areas.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
I think similar to Laura, I did not have a traditional trajectory into student affairs. I started out as, and now it would be considered enrollment management. I started out as an academic advisor. No strategy around that. I simply needed a job. I had planned to graduate. I was going to move to New York. I was going to dread my hair, live in the village, and write for the Village Voice. That had been my goal out of college. Sally Mae came knocking. I said, well, I think I need a job. I had just met my now husband. We've been together for 26 years. And so I know that's a long time. So we had just met, and I didn't want to leave. And so I found a job. And then from there, I've had a very eclectic career path. I have been both in and outside of the classroom. You know, I don't even really like that term, but I have. I've been a faculty member. I've been academic advising. I've just done about just about everything and worked at all different kind of institutions. I think the thing for me is similar in terms of the crisis management. And I think if anyone is considering this as a career path, I think you need to really think deeply about that and how it impacts you and how you have to manage that process. The big thing, though, is you're never 100% sure all the time that you're going to make the right decision. And the decisions can have large repercussions, right, in terms of, and sometimes a life concerns. And so that's what kind of keeps you up at night. And you're having to not only make a decision, but articulate a decision to people who don't always do your work. Mm-hmm. And it may seem that the decision is very subjective, but it's really based around data and matrices, right? That involve, you know, years of experience. And so I think that's it. You know, I've not run into a crisis that I couldn't manage yet, but I do still have those moments like, am I making the right decision?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Daryl. And I remember it was, I think, the second day on the job when the local police department showed up with an arrest warrant for a student and everyone looked at me and said, oh, well, Laura will tell us what to do. And so there's this idea that, you know, someone in the VPSA role is going to know exactly how to handle these kinds of situations. And it is the reality. And I'm glad you mentioned that we don't always know the right thing to do, but we have tools to figure it out and experience to use to figure it out. But there is sometimes this idea that, oh, this is a student related issue, so the VPSA will know exactly how to handle this.
And sort of the pressure to instill confidence mm-hmm. in your colleagues and supervisees while proceeding in situations that you're not 100% sure how
right.
yes. to navigate.
Exactly.
Especially in your first year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a big thing, right? Mm-hmm. And my mom has a saying, she'll say it now, like if I call her and vent, she'll say, well, to whom much is given, much is required. And I was like, every time I face something, my mom's ringing in my head. I was just like, oh, yeah, you're right.
That's like a classic mom thing.
Yeah.
So I had I had a conversation with my mom that was similar, and they're always dropping words of wisdom.
You used that one, Daryl.
Yeah.
thank your mom.
Yeah. So if we start to segue now into some of the kind of bigger questions that we wanted to get some feedback from you all on. We talk a lot about the various balls in the air, constantly shifting gears in the work. And so if we jump into some of these, Laura, we can start with you, and then anybody else can jump in. So how do vice presidents manage the kind of balance of having to maintain the higher level of focus to see kind of everything fitting together, but also dealing with the different fires that might have to get put out and getting into the weeds on certain things?
Yeah, that's for me been the biggest challenge and exciting part of the job. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about what we meant by that, about in terms of shifting gears. Certainly in any leadership role, you're having to think about the big picture, the micro and the macro at the same time, but it's really amplified, especially in the VPSA role at a small college where there aren't as many layers between the vice president and the front line folks and the day-to-day. So it took me probably about 6 months, and I think it was actually even in a conversation with Heather where I realized that this was why it was feeling really kind of at the end of the day, feeling like really exhausted. Like, why am I so tired from the day? Mm-hmm. And it was this thing of having to shift gears. So I kind of thought back to a day where, an example where you're in a meeting talking about long-term institutional strategic planning, and then you might go right from that to meeting with a student who's experiencing a lot of distress or a problem, and then right from that to a meeting about using the athletic logo, and then from that to a meeting about a grant application, and then from that to talking with one of your managers about some supervisor challenges or team dynamic challenges that they're having. And between all of those, you're walking down the hall and someone's stopping you and asking you a question, or you run into a student that you want to connect with. And so just kind of keeping all of those things moving from one thing to the next, I think is really the challenge. So there's that literal shifting gears of like, I've been in this kind of conversation and now I need to move to this kind of conversation and figure out how to be fully present for each of those conversations. That's the hard part. But then also I feel like you're kind of shifting gears depending on so if you're in a larger scale strategic meeting, you're kind of thinking about the students, right? Like how do I keep the students at top of mind in this conversation? How do I keep the student experience present in the conversation? And then you might be meeting with a student or with a staff member where you're thinking, how do I help this person see the big picture? Mm-hmm. How do I help this person understand what's happening to them in the context of what's happening at the larger institution? So you're literally having to shift perspectives as well as shift gears. And that can be, really needing to hold for yourself both of those, the micro and the macro, at all times. And I think that can be really, it's what's really cool about the job and what's really interesting about the job. And then the last part, and both Heather and Daryl spoke to this, is the really genuine shifting of gears that has to happen when there is a crisis. That you could be sitting in a meeting, having a great conversation, you're all working on something, and then you get a call, you got to go be present for that. And then sometimes go right back to, something where you're still in the mind of this experience. Maybe a student was hospitalized, or maybe a staff member is really working through having been involved in a crisis, but you've got to go right back to this other situation and go back into the conversation about the strategic plan, or where you're still holding all of those feelings and connections and concern and worry for people in your community or members of your community. And that can happen even, we take calls at night, we take calls when we're with our family, we take calls when things are going on in our personal life. And so there's that whole part of the shifting gears too, is, how do I attend to what I need to attend to, but also be able to shift back and be present. And being present for all of those things, I think, is the you know, the biggest challenge in all of that is how do I give myself to whatever I'm dealing with fully, but also take care of my own energy in terms of all of this transition. So I would give a couple of, and I think we're going to come back to it, but just a couple things that came to mind for how to do that, which I learned a little later than I would have liked to. One is building in time, you know, between figuring out not to have all of those meetings back to back, which was a lesson I did not learn early enough. You know, giving yourself time to walk in between or spend a little time in your office or just process what has been going on. I saw in the last hour of my day as a no meeting time, so that I have that time to like think back on the day, look ahead to what's happening the next day, and really kind of think. And sometimes things intrude into that, but I try to preserve that as like time to collect and reflect on the day and get ready for the next day. Finding your people. We have those people here, but it can also be someone, a trusted person on your staff. For me, it's, you know, having some folks on my leadership team that I can be transparent with and talk about and bounce things off and debrief some things, or a fellow colleague on the cabinet. And then just being realistic too about what you can do. So for me, because I came up into the role in a place I had worked for a long time, there was a lot that it was hard for me to let go of. Things I had been involved in before I became the vice president, things that I was used to being hands-on with that I didn't need necessarily to be hands-on with anymore. So I think that's an important thing to spend some time reflecting on, is this something I actually need to be involved in? I have folks who can take care of this, so I need to let them take care of it. This is something I'm really invested in, but maybe I don't have to be the one doing it. So kind of figuring out how to put your energy is going to have to be divided and shifted, but also being careful about where you put that energy.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I heard anything in there about self-care, Laura, but I'm going to put a plug for that.
Yes.
I mean, as you were talking about that, you know, actual sort of the literal shift you have to make, and the shift in perspective and the pace of the day. And the day doesn't really end because you have things that come up,
right,
you know, after hours that you need to respond to. And just holding all of that,
mm-hmm.
it is a lot to carry. And mm-hmm. I think as I was hearing you reflect on your experience, and so much of that resonated with me, and I started to actually feel the weight of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I was thinking again, what are we doing to take care mm-hmm. of ourselves? Because we are the ones taking care of everyone else here.
Right. Yes. You know,
we're the ones that are ensuring that we're taking care of our students, taking care of our team, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I think I would just add, you know, that to me, I think has almost equal urgency in order for us to continue to serve well in the role, whether that's literally, I'm going to build in lunch today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I'm going to just take like a quick walk around campus, or whatever that is that you can fit in. So necessary.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, and I think you, to that point, you know, when I first went into the work context of being a student and seeing my dean of students at the time at my institution, and just thinking like, wow, like he, back then, you know, he would go to the gym every day for about 2 hours. And, you know, he always left at 5. And I thought like, wow, that's the life, you know, I want that life. And I think the work has exponentially changed now. But I think, and I worked at a really large school prior to coming to a smaller campus. And I think that's something to factor into it as well. So at a big school, my school was 52,000 students, so it's huge. And we had combined with a 2-year college, so we had like 6 different campuses. So it's just no way for you to really get around that, even though the work is, you know, really difficult. At smaller colleges, it's so much more personal because you get to see people, or you could say something that offends someone. Or for me, it really affected a lot of triggers in me, a lot of triggers around my sexuality, that I was projecting on the school. You know, this is my first time working at an HBCU. And as a gay Black man, I had a lot of things going on in my head about that. I would take a lot of things personally, wouldn't lash out, but would come home and just carry that with me. And so, you know, this year I, you know, got a therapist, right? And it has been amazing. And I think we talk a lot about that to our students, and we talk a lot about, you know, wellness, and we're checking on our staff. But what that has done is it has allowed me an opportunity to sort some things out that has actually made me a better practitioner, right? If I could, you know, vulnerably share, it was, I grew up first generation and poor, and I work in a very privileged institution now, and that was a trigger for me. And so when people would come with a sense of privilege, I had my own, you know, psychosis around that and what that meant. And so being able to do that has been extremely beneficial. The other thing that my president did, which was amazing, was to get me a professional coach. And that was really helpful. She waited until my first year in the job, which was a perfect timing. And then I got the coach. And so I was able to just really sound some things off. She told me something that really changed my perspective. She asked me to define myself. And I started with the first generation. I'm first generation, you know, I'm this and whatever. And she said, no, that's not your story any longer. She said, you are the head of a major corporation. You're the CEO of a major corporation. You are a, at best, upper middle class African-American who's probably closer to the 1% than what you want to admit. And that was so helpful because it changed my narrative, right? And my thought process in terms of who I was now versus where I've come from. So I advise people to think about that, you know, coaching if possible, asking your bosses, can they get you a coach? And then definitely therapy and exercise. I'm an exercise junkie. So, yeah.
I'm not yet. The only time I've gone into our gym is to give tours. And that was back.
That was exercise. You were walking in the gym.
That's true. I pointed. You know, I worked the arms too. So.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Triceps. Yeah. Shoulders. Delts. You did the whole workout.
That's right. So thank you all for sharing first. We heard Laura talk about her kind of success strategies for the how to shift gears from the higher level big picture things and the down in the weeds sort of things that come up day to day. Daryl, Heather, I'll open it to you. Strategies that might be different from Laura that you find that worked well for you?
I tell you one little trick that I've had to do, Laura, I was listening to you. I wasn't being present, right? It's not my natural inclination to be present anyway. I have two children and one of my sons is just like me. He when I'm talking to him, he's like, yeah, daddy, okay, daddy, okay. Not listening to nothing I'm saying, right? The first three words are left. And I'm I wasn't being very present. So I just got one of those fit spinners. And so now my staff laugh about it. They're like, oh, okay, now you're listening to me. Like I'll pick up the fit spinner when I feel my thoughts are moving because, you know, I need to be present when I'm talking to someone individually. I need to give them, you know, at least 90% of myself, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I pull out the fit spinner and I just spin it, and then that means, you know, I'm focusing, right? I'm listening to what you're saying. And now they recognize that. And so I think that empowers them because then they're saying, you know, I'm hearing you, you know? The second thing that I did, I had my staff to do a 360 evaluation on me, which was empowering, I think, for both of us. Because nobody is going to tell you, Dr. Holloman, you are not listening to me. You know, Dr. Holloman, you are crap, right? And they will either act out, sometimes I found passive aggressively, right, to get me to listen. When I could resolve that, by just listening in the first place. So that's one of my techniques that I've started to do.
A couple things came to mind. I would say back to how to actually manage some of the flow of shifting gears so quickly throughout my day. I do take a lot of control of my own calendar. I feel like that's helpful for me, but I also have a very trusted coordinator and executive assistant. And sometimes I'll just, you know, say to her, could you please like build in some space in my calendar? And I really trust her to be able to manage things and kind of understand my flow and what I need. And that has been extremely helpful. The other thing for me is, you know, because I think the work can feel heavy sometimes, of course there are rewards, right? I don't think any of us would do this without it feeling meaningful and rewarding. I believe not, but it can feel heavy. And I think one of the things that has been really helpful for me is to find those ways to have meaningful connections with students that are really uplifting and that remind me why I'm doing this work. I know it may sound silly, but one of the ways I've done that at my current institution and the previous institution was dancing with students. Oh. So I advise the dance club at my last institution, and I teach Zumba at the institution where I work now. And just those chances to kind of be a real person, you know, not just an administrator, and to engage with students in a way that's really just outside of the norm for, you know, our business relationship. It's really fun. It's for me really energizing, and it sort of helps offset some of the weight and the pace, the busyness and the pace of things.
Vice presidents inherit staff and structure that they may not have assembled or created in the same way. And so depending on the circumstances, some vice presidents find themselves in a supervisory role to people who were once colleagues, or needing to restructure or realign services where change doesn't usually come easy. And so Dr. Holloman, we'll have you start here. Is there, what is the roadmap for success in those sorts of situations?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I had a really interesting experience, right? I was, again, the only man in a pool of six other very qualified women. Two of them ended up reporting to me. And one of them is my really good friend, who had always articulated in graduate school that her dream was to work at Spelman, right? And so when I got into the role, there was a lot of concern about me as a man and would I be able to relate to the experiences of Black women. And so, you know, just kind of coming into that sense with two people who were had also applied for the job, they were qualified people who had qualified for the job. I also had a real interesting dynamic between millennials all the way to like the industrial age, right? So the age range of my staff went from people in their late to early 30s all the way to like their mid 70s. And so when we were in meetings, they would actually sit according to their age category, right? The millennials would be on one side, texting, looking at their phones, and the others would be on the other side, highly offended that they were texting and looking at their phones, right? And their communication styles were different. You know, millennials truly believe in groupthink, and the industrial age is definitely older, are definitely hierarchical, right? And so millennials are questioning me, right, to really get a sense of where I am, and they're asking me to be authentic. And then my other half of the table was like, that's not how a vice president acts, right? And so we ended up investing in a wonderful facilitator to come in, and she did an exercise for us on the development of our leadership voices. So I actually designated some resources to hire this person. I met with her, I vetted with her, and she guided us through this wonderful exercise where looked at whether we were creative, a connector, a nurturer, a guardian, or a pioneer. It's called the five leadership voices. You can Google it. And what was amazing about that was once we got people outside of a sense of their age group and their category classification in that regard, and they started to see themselves with these different leadership voices, what they recognized was, oh my goodness, I'm in the category and I'm similar to people that look, you know, very differently and act very differently than myself. It was helpful for me because I have always assumed that I'm a nurturer, even though my children repeatedly have told me I'm not. I just assumed I was a nurturer, but I'm actually a pioneer. And it's a whole different way that I order the world. And nurturing is actually the last box that I fit into. It's the thing that I'm the least. So I didn't really have a good sense of who I was as an individual. So we've been doing that as a collective group. Unfortunately, with the COVID, we was not able to bring the facilitator back. Well, we might be able to in July, bring the facilitator back for our last session. One last point, because I don't want to dominate, but this is my sweet spot. Like, I love this in professional development and policy. What she did for us was also to, all my directors got 360 evaluations of themselves, which was powerful for them. And then she had done out of our retreat, there were two things that my team said they didn't, that were issues. They didn't trust one another. Some of that was along the age category. And the other was that they weren't working together as cohesively as they should. And so we were able to kind of spend the year doing that. Our next year is all about data enrichment. And so if we're able to, we're gonna bring in folks who can really help us understand data. So that's my spiel.
I would add maybe a couple of things when I'm thinking about, and it's interesting, Daryl, I don't know if I realized that you had two people that report to you that had also been candidates for the position. That was my experience as well coming into my current role, where one of my direct reports now was in the interim role and was a candidate for the position. And everything that I've heard about that dynamic would have led me to believe, oh geez, this is going to be problematic. But I have to say, I don't know what the statistics are on that. Like, I don't know percentage wise how often it goes south. But I would say in my particular situation, I feel incredibly grateful. This is a very beloved staff member on campus. Someone that has a lot of institutional history, is really, really excellent at what she does. And honestly, I just feel lucky to be able to work with her. So I'm really grateful, but I can understand, because certainly coming into this situation, I was apprehensive about it. The other thing in terms of inheriting staff that I experienced was I probably came in a little bit Pollyanna-ish and was hoping that we were all just going to sing Kumbaya together right away. Yeah. And that did not happen. In fact, there had been a lot of transition in leadership in recent years before I got there. And the team was pretty disjointed, very distrustful, and really not so interested in team building. So right from the start, that was a challenge for me. And one of the things that I did to try and address that was just, again, relationship building and transparency. For right out of the gate, very first week I was there, and for several weeks, including sometimes now I'll still do it, I would say, we're going to have straight talk with Heather. Whatever you want to ask, put it on the table. We're all together. I'm going to answer you honestly. If there's something I can't answer, I will let you know that I can't answer it and why. And we're just going to lay it out there. Some of those conversations were extremely tense and difficult, I will be honest. But I think now, looking back on it, I honestly don't think we could have gotten just, 2 months of the COVID epidemic if we hadn't been able to come together as a team. And I believe that was a helpful factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would echo everything that Heather and Daryl said. I had the additional wrinkle of working with people or supervising folks who had been my peers before. So that, you know, I had a leadership team, some of whom had been my colleagues and some of whom had been people that I had hired and trained. And so just kind of settling into that dynamic of, and even across the institution, people that had known me as a colleague and then now had to see me in this different role. So, so I think that that it took some time to kind of, you know, build trust in this new kind of dynamic and new kind of relationship, and also to learn all of the folks that I didn't supervise before and didn't really have a sense of dynamics and challenges. And so there was one section of the department that's under my purview now that I used to supervise and built and knew all those folks and had hired everyone and knew the training and the philosophy that they had, that had been built into that area. And then there was two other areas that I hadn't supervised before and didn't hire those people. And so kind of figure out how to bring everybody into the same approach and without, you know, stepping on what had been done before in those teams. And so just kind of navigating and bringing everybody together, I think, is a different kind of challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Vice presidents and senior student affairs officers sometimes carry the weight of knowing highly sensitive and confidential information, and so I can imagine the burden of knowing or being the ultimate decision maker, right, in sometimes difficult situations. And so, Dr. French, we'll start with you. Is there a way to balance being good stewards with the heavy information and not allowing it to weigh on you?
I can share a few things that have been helpful for me, and we may have touched a little bit on this before, but the first thing that comes to mind is really establishing a network of other vice presidents for student affairs or SSAOs to be able to process some of these situations with, even just to say, oh my gosh, my day, I can't believe it, because they will understand. But really, you know, I've been over the last almost 2 years talking with some close colleagues like Laura and Daryl and being able to share some of my experiences to make sense of them. And some of the takeaways for me have been things like, you know, wanting to really understand all sides of the situation. You know, is it something that I can get behind? Is it something that I feel like I need to advocate differently for? Is it something that I'm going to feel a certain way about? And can I respond in a way that is measured, or will I be triggered and reactionary? Mm-hmm. Really thinking about, I like that one of my colleagues used this phrase, the price of transparency. You know, if it is something that I feel is important enough to share with folks, particularly like my direct reports, how much do I share? With whom do I share? When? Really understanding that there's a trade-off and, you know, understanding for myself as I make those informed decisions, you know, whether to share something or to keep that information confidential. And then again, holding that weight of knowing that information. And then of course, you know, when it is appropriate and sharing that, particularly with my supervisees, thinking about how they might react, what kind of process they might have or need to have some time to respond. And then being, like I mentioned, that sort of straight talk with Heather, being able to just really hear them out, be able to answer questions, be clear, talk through, you know, what decisions mean, what and be pretty transparent about what the impact might be. Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the things that I've taken away from conversations I've had with colleagues. And I think just building that network where we can have that sounding board among one another is really, really helpful. The second thing I would say is really being able to have a confidant, maybe who's completely outside of education, to offer a very different perspective. My partner is a project manager, and our work worlds are incredibly different. So I might be really deeply processing something that's going on at work, and you know, we'll be on a walk and I'll on and on be talking about this, and she'll just be like, okay, well, this other thing.
They glaze over. They're like,
yes. And it also just puts it in perspective. Like, I get that that's really weighing on you, but life is happening in all these other places. Yeah. Like just to give you some perspective and not to really dwell on things that I might be holding. And of course, to be just a person who's there as like my cheerleader and my support person. Is always helpful. And then the third and last thing I would say is, you know, when it does feel particularly heavy, and I know, again, I reflect just the time that we're in right now and all the work that all of us have been doing to navigate this unprecedented situation, reminding myself that, you know, I was hired in this role for a reason. The leadership of the college, the board, the president, my colleagues all believe in me and trusted me when they hired me. And believe in myself, you know, find whatever it is that I need to pull from, to believe in myself, to be able to trust that what I'm doing is with the very best intentions and is going to yield the very best outcome. I really firmly believe that we're all, especially at this time, but really in this role, we're doing the best we can to navigate these situations as they come up. And to be able to find that balance for me is, you know, just being able to take those moments away to find moments of gratitude. Remember that life isn't all about whatever the current crisis is that we're dealing with, whether that's, you know, being with my partner or my son or dancing or eating yummy food, whatever that is. Work is a big part of my life and it's hugely meaningful, but it's helpful to be able to have balance as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, Heather. I think as you were talking, I was thinking about how that holding of information is not just in terms of staff, but sometimes really comes up in terms of students that, you know, sometimes you have to make really, really difficult decisions that students feel really unhappy about or don't understand because they don't have the whole picture. And when a student is sitting in front of you saying, you know, why did my friend get kicked out of school? Or, you know, you don't care or whatever it is, like you can't explain why you had to make the decisions. And you do just have to have that internal compass of like, I know that this is a thoughtful decision. I know it's been made with the best interest of everybody in mind. And this person, it's causing them pain, but it's still, we still feel like it's the right, you still have to trust that you've made a good decision and that maybe the person in front of you doesn't have the whole picture and doesn't. But also honor that it's upsetting to them. And as you said, you know, figure out how to help them through that. But I appreciate what you said about Heather, about it. Just trusting that we're here for a reason and we have the perspective and the experience to make good decisions.
Yeah, it's almost, it's our calling, right?
Yeah.
It's
our calling.
And so you just have to, you'll know it, you know?
Yeah, yep.
In it, yeah.
And it sounds like it's, like that's good advice for anybody at, you know, any level, you're not supposed to be perfect, but you are trusted. And so, yeah, very, very good stuff. So we touched on the support system in terms of finding your confidant and your crew. But where else might people in this role go for support and development, whether that's on campus or off?
I will put in a plug here for the NASPA Small College and University Division.
I was waiting for the plug.
Oh my goodness. I have to say, I mean, NASPA in general is a fantastic organization. And for anyone that might be listening who isn't involved in a professional organization, we really encourage you to just if you are a small college professional, the SCU division has so many great resources and really focuses on our unique experiences at these type of institutions. And I think, you know, for me, that has been one of the most supportive ways to build professional network and also to contribute back to the field.
Absolutely. And I would just say too, y'all reach out to your NASPA colleagues, the liaison or the office staff. I mean, this COVID-19 is hitting our organization really hard. And just please just send them a note. Just say you appreciate them and you're thankful of the work that they're doing, because they are really working diligently to continue to support us. So let's get back a little bit to them too.
Yeah. I also, you know, in addition to reaching out to colleagues in your own institution or that you've worked with in other places, there is in the Bay Area a network of small college deans and VPs, which Heather was involved in before she left, that's been really, really beneficial, because we're all not exactly similar institutions, but similar scope and size, and we meet once a quarter and just get together and talk about how things are going. And during this beginning of the COVID, we were sending each other emails back and forth about, you know, what are you doing? What decisions are you making? How it was really helpful to kind of balance that with people in your local area that were kind of dealing with things in the same way, to really get advice and bounce things around. So find a network of people in your area, I think, that is in addition to the national networks and to the NASPA networks, but also finding people in your own area that are working in similar environments, I think is really important.
Yeah, I'm really close to the chief student affairs officers at Morehouse and Clark Atlanta. Like, we all came in about the same time. One has been there longer than us at Morehouse, but came into the role at the same time. And that has just been amazing. Like, those brothers texted me this morning, and they were like, hey, how y'all doing? We're just checking in. Mm-hmm. When are we going to have our virtual happy hour? You know, and that's been amazing, because I think we are one of the first cohorts to really work so closely together. Mm-hmm. And our staff recognize that. And so I remember once we were out and we were just laughing and joking and talking about it. It was a big problem. We had, in the fall, we had a shooting on one of our promenades on campus, and it impacted every one of our campuses. Mm-hmm. We were processing and talking about it. And one of my colleague staff members said, oh my God, that we've never seen that before. Like, y'all really get along. And I was like, yeah, we love each other, you know? And so I think that's important too. This is not an island unto itself.
Yeah.
That is what will burn you out. That's what will kill you physically and mentally. If you think I can do this all by myself, share with people that you trust. I will say that. I'm a verbal processor. I've learned sometimes I could shut up.
build your VP's council. That is the key.
Exactly.
Well, I think that about does it for our time. So I want to thank the three of you for joining me on the first episode of the Small College and Universities Division podcast. For the first episode of 2020. What a time to be alive. What a time we're living in. So thank you very much. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you want to be featured on the NASPA Small College and Universities Division podcast, feel free to use our contact information in the show notes below to figure out how to talk about all of the good work that you are doing. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.